My name is Eleanor Futcher, and I'm from Oakland, California, and tonight we're going to be talking about dreams and Jung's psychology. So I will introduce our topic and talk a little bit about the history of dreams and a little bit about personal experience. The idea that dreams influence and inspire our waking lives is as old as dreaming itself. Clay tablets found in Assyria contain recorded interpretations of dreams believed to date back 1,000 years. So what's happened that we're just beginning in the last 50 years or so to think about dreams again? In the early centuries of the church, Christians generally welcomed dreams with openness, viewing them as a setting for encounter with God and one's deepest self. A drastic shift in attitude happened between the 4th and 5th centuries. So strong was the resistance to dreams that negative attitudes toward them and toward dream work persisted until our own century, and actually, it wasn't until Freud that again we began to explore the meaning or the value of dreams. Why did we hear so little from Christian writers about dreams and dream work until the latter half of the 20th century? What happened to dreams in the church as a means of discovering God's will in the lives of people? If you want answers to some of those questions, you can read this book. It's one of the really good ones. It has a lot of information about how to work with dreams and dreams and spiritual growth. You'll see it in the library or in the bookstore, and there's a lot of other books which Roy will speak about. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit about how I became interested in dreams. 50 years ago, when I was a little girl, my mother used to talk about her dreams, and we would listen and not think too much about it or take it too seriously. But we respected it, and she found meaning in her dreams. And one time, shortly before she died, we were talking about her death, and she said, "You know, I'm really not afraid of dying, but I really can't bear to think of being under the ground, because she would be buried." And she said, "That's what really scares me." And she said, "But I had a dream, and in the dream, I just woke knowing that I am not going to be under the ground." And she said, "I don't feel a bit afraid anymore, and I don't even think about it." And my interest was piqued after that, and I would talk about some of my dreams to her, and I talked about a dream that I had in which I was choking, and I told her the dream, and I said, "You know, Mom, I think that I only could experience it now because I couldn't as a child have experienced the depth of grief that I would have had given the circumstance of my father's illness and my childhood." So again, I said, that dream is helping me to grieve my childhood that I was incapable of accessing to the depth that I would have felt it. So I've been very interested, and so we're going to be pretty serious about dreams tonight. But before we get serious, I have dreams. I don't see what you're supposed to do about dreams. You're always asleep when they happen. Perhaps sleep is to blame, pulling the wool over your eyes in that deceitful way it has. Dreams wouldn't dare do what they do to me when I'm awake. That's why they wait until I'm asleep before they do it. Dreams are merciless. They come upon you when you're asleep. So that's a little light way of talking about dreams. We often hear people say, "I had the crazy dream last night." It's a way of pushing it away. But if you began to say, "Well, there were all these images in my dream last night, and I wonder what they mean." If you approached it that way, you would be amazed at the difference in how you would respect your inner life. All of us have dreams, and some people insist they don't, but it was probably in the 40s, well, actually as late as the 50s, at the University of California, I remember the research that was going on, and it was as recent as then that we began to discover through research that every 90 minutes, all night, in progressively longer periods, our central nervous system undergoes an active phase, 25% of which is REM or rapid eye movement time. And what was discovered was, and I imagine a lot of you know this, but that if you'd be wakened in this rapid eye movement time, that would be the time that you were dreaming. And it was also discovered that if you were awakened consistently over a period of time, that you became a little confused. I remember hearing some of the people that were in the research saying that you actually got a little paranoid and psychotic temporarily, because dreams have their balancing effect whether we work with them or not. And they've also discovered that babies dream, and they dream even more than adults because so much of their life is spent sleeping. So they're in REM sleep a lot more time than adults, and we're wondering if that's the way a baby, a child, begins to put his world together on the unconscious level, because he's taking in so much all day long, and whenever he's awake, he's taking in all this new environment. The dream that you have right before you wake, the last time before you wake is usually the one you remember or forget. However, if you don't do much with dreams, you're not going to remember it. But that's usually the one that you'll work with, because the others kind of escape you unless they're, well, they'll usually wake you if they're pretty powerful. And the reoccurring dream is the one you want to pay attention, special attention to. How many of you have reoccurring dreams? That's the one you really want to work with. Find someone to work with it. Talk about it. And tonight you can hear a little more about how you might do that. Because it seems like the reoccurring dream is there because you have not completed something that your psyche says you're ready to complete. And it will keep coming until you perform that task in your life, make that change or movement. And the reoccurring dream that I had as a child was always around sexuality and being chased, until I came to terms with my own body and my own sexual energies, I had that dream. And I haven't had that for years. Even if you don't believe in dreams, they believe in you, and they occur regularly during your sleeping hours. They are helping you to keep in a state of balance. Deprived of dream sleep, as I told you, people could become pretty dysfunctional and confused. And remembered or not, your dreams serve an important purpose, which at the lowest level assures your survival. And at the highest, when we pay attention and work with them, increase the possibility for growth. The dream comes in the service of health and wholeness. The desire of the soul to unite with consciousness and forge an indivisible and creative personality, the urge toward wholeness and the urge to find God are identical and are the most powerful urges within us. We ignore this urge to our peril, because we turn our backs on our deepest longing. And God has many ways of speaking to us, and dreams are one of them. And I would think that my mother would have thought and said that God had spoken to her through her dream around her dying, because deep inside of her, something new, she would have called that God. Through our growing body of psychological knowledge, we have learned to interpret dreams for one another and for ourselves. Though the archaic language of dreams is difficult to understand, there are ways to break the language barrier that are both teachable and available. And one of, as I said, one of the ways God's purposes for us can be discovered and clarified is through the understanding of our dreams. And Roy will talk about ways of working with them. The work of the Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung stands as a monument to man's ability to unlock the mysteries of the unconscious through the interpretation of dreams. And I just am so grateful for the work that he's done and for the contribution he's made to my life, because what he's done is helped me to see that the unconscious, the negative forces within me, are where all the energy lies, and that if I can harness that energy and not let it run me, that it is there when I access that part of myself. It is there that my creativity, my spontaneity, and my individual gifts can be expressed, and my spirituality. If you will, God.
Okay. We're going to pick up on Carl Jung, psychiatrist, and perhaps many of you know too. He was a grew up in a parsonage in Switzerland, so that he had a family, Christian family, and experience the faith and the church by growing up as a PK, shall we say. And I guess it was actually a Lutheran in the Reformed part of Switzerland. But one of the things that struck him, it was a time of the Victorian age. He was born in about 1880, 82, somewhere in there. So. Around 1900s, he'd be a young fellow and a kid growing up in 1890, 1900s, a Victorian era. And also, that was probably a rather dry time theologically. That is, a lot of orthodoxy. And beliefs were held very firmly, kind of rigidly, and particularly, I think, in Switzerland, where he grew up. And this showed in the family, too. And the father, as the years went by, seemed to be unhappy and frustrated and unfulfilled in his vocation, and was depressed at times. But there were some other stresses in the family. I won't go into that. But that created a real concern or a problem, questions for him. So in a way, his life work then became to explore religious experience or the Christian experience, and to find some of the answers, because he, like as a kid, he felt for his father, while he kind of felt alienated some by some of the things that were mystified by some of the things going on. He had a deep concern for where was the joy? Where was the creativity and the love and the affection and so on? And so it was sort of dried, had dried up in a sense. So through the years then, as he trained as a physician and then went into psychiatry, and he worked with Freud, and eventually split from Freud because Freud had a very negative attitude or a more analytical, psychological approach to religion. In one sense, Freud hadn't resolved his own religious issues with his Jewish faith. So Jung eventually broke away and worked much with dreams and developed a psychology that was not based on a medical model, which the Freudian is based on illness and pathology, and would categorize things in terms of what's well and what's sick. And Jung, you might say, developed a psychology that would be for all people, for so-called normal people, and is a holistic approach to the psyche. And so that caused a great split in terms of the psychoanalytic movement, and he was and went through a really rough time of feeling alienated and isolated from many of his colleagues. And then he began a search and a study of dreams and of the spiritual basis of them, and studied the Christian faith and other religious, like the Eastern meditation. So he was kind of open-ended and brought a kind of scientific or a science commitment to it. And let's see how I've laid out some of how he comprehends the psyche. But before we move into that, I'd just like to emphasize something about the subjective and the objective. And this really kind of relates to Jung as well, as far as that goes. And it's particularly impressed me or hit me in recent. Because the world that Jung dealt with and psychology deals with is the realm of the subjective. The subjective, we are subjects. The subjects are persons. Even the word suggests, you know, subject, even subject of a king, subject of God. But anyway, a person. Whereas the objective world is a world of objects, of impersonal world. Now this side is the external world that we're also familiar with, and you know, it's so obvious and it seems so real, and a lot of times we are impressed and get caught up in the so-called real world, as if this is really the only real world. And science basically works mostly in this world, although in psychology we are working in this world. And the spiritual, the religious life is all in this realm, and that is an inner world. And it is just as real as the outer physical objective world. A lot of times we mix the two and we get a confusion going about, we don't keep clear maybe when we are thinking and dealing with the object world from our subjective world, which is the world of persons. Now this is the world in which Jesus spoke of the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is with you, within you. Remember, he's speaking to the Pharisees and he says something, they're asking him about the Spirit. And he says, where is the Spirit? He says, lo, it may be here or there. The Spirit does not come with signs and fanfare, but lo, behold, the Spirit is like the wind. You cannot see it, but it moves, and lo, the Spirit, and then he concludes it with, and the Spirit of God, or the Spirit is within you, or among you. So the world of the Spirit, the spiritual realm, is strictly kind of, is in this realm of us, is in us as persons, or between us as individuals, or as a group. This is the realm of the Spirit. And when Jesus uses the phrases the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of Spirit, or the kingdom of God, it's kind of a poetic phrase, or maybe it also carries a mystery with it. But maybe we might tend to make it too transcendental or something or mysterious. But in actuality, it's the very real world that we live in every day and every moment. So, and well, let's see. So this is the realm then that Jung developed a structure and understanding of the psyche, which is the word for soul. The ego is our conscious center. It is, and the persona or our public self is a kind of part, is really part of the ego. It is a way we present ourselves to each other. I'm a minister, counselor. You're a, Nancy's a nurse as well.
It's the way you survive in the world.
Yeah. And the way we dress, the way we want to present ourselves, that is our public self. We also, well, when you say we, the way we survive, a lot of times we have patterns, the way we defend ourselves. We are pleasant, we are nice, we may want to avoid conflict. The persona is a protective aspect of our personality. It is a useful part of our personality, but also it can hide or cover other dimensions of our personality. And then there beneath this would be the shadow element, the hidden first level of the unconscious area, and that would also be, could, you know, a broader label for it would be the personal unconscious. This would have to do with our family of origin, our parents, siblings, and various things that happened to us as we grew up through the years. So that's the level of the personal unconscious. I might mention that the shadow archetype is of the same sex as you, as the ego. So the shadow in my dreams would be masculine or men, and you know, for women would be women. Then beneath the personal would be the collective unconscious, and here we'd have a lot of different archetypal, like them, but could be, there's the feminine archetype, the animum and animus, the masculine and the feminine. For the man, there is a secondary or an inferior side of his feminine qualities, feminine sensitivities, and likewise for the woman. So then the anima would be portrayed by a feminine figure in the dreams, and the animus by a masculine figure in the dream. Also, there may be an old, wise old man and a wise old woman. There could be other figures. Let's see, other examples of the collective might be institutional, police, but the policeman could also be a shadow figure. But also, an institutional figure represents the collective of law or tyrannical government, we'll say, and these figures could be archetypal dimensions. Then the main archetype, central archetype, is that of what Jung called the self. In the scriptures, we often speak of the image of God, of humans being made in the image of God, and or of the Christ within. That the Christ is, in our Christian faith, I would say, is the self in Jung's terms. The dotted line here between the ego and the self is spoken of in psychology as the ego-self axis. The ego is in service, or needs to be in service, in connection with the self and with the unconscious. I think in putting it in Christian terms, it's like the ego is steward. We are stewards of the life that we have been given, of the energies, the abilities, of our bodies,
and gifts,
various gifts. Mm-hmm. So, or you could say servant. And then the deep center is a guidance for us. Dreams basically come from this area. So that as the ego, our I, or our conscious self, is aware of a particular dream, it is bringing a greater wisdom, knowing about what's going on with you, than you, just the ego, are aware of. Any questions as I'm going along? Anyway, that certainly supports the value of dreams. Let's say a little bit what happens when an infant or person starts life as an infant. The way this is understood or conceived is that the archetype of the self really contains the whole person. There isn't too much of an ego in a little infant. But I imagine in utero that the ego might be beginning. Because a child hears, there's a very small beginning. And then the child is born, and for a good while it feels like it is still part of the mother. It has not developed an ego yet enough to differentiate. And pretty much all it knows is it cries, it gets attention, you know, and gets fed and so on. But gradually the ego develops, gets more awareness, and maybe mentioned about sleeping and the development that's going on and taking all the data in that the little child takes in. And gradually the ego emerges, well, 1 year, 1.5, 2 years, there's a beginnings of a pretty good ego. We talk about the terrible twos, when the little child wants to be independent and run off and do its own thing and pushes the adult away. We have a little granddaughter about 16 months, and when we want a sister, she pushes you away, or because she wanted to do this thing herself now. So the ego begins to emerge, and let's see. The main thing is anyway that the ego emerges as a separate entity from the larger developing process of a person. Injuries and traumas that occur in childhood disrupt this axis, and the child, there can be an injury. In fact, there's no way that the injury between ego and the self does not occur. But growth comes through some of that injury. And that the child, I don't know if I should call it injury, but hurt, wound, it's a self, and a presenting itself. And sometimes the choices aren't always the best. We create certain ways of protecting ourselves, and they kind of become habit. And then maybe later in adult life, maybe what is established there, let's say you chose a way of withdrawing to cope with stress and conflict in a family situation. Well, that works for a time, and it protects. It's useful at the time. But as a life stands, it's not going to work. It's going to break down. So that when you need to engage and open up, you've got to break through that habit. So usually then something happens in a relationship and where you've maybe been withdrawn and you experience a loss or a disruption, and then you have to come to terms with yourself and say, hey, I got to do something about this and open up. So that's a kind of a sketch of this ego self axis process and how the dream then plays a big part in, well, let's say, coping with the stresses, the traumas, the stretching that goes on in our development or growing up, but also for the ego to pay attention to and to make some sense out of these things. When Paul says, "What know ye not that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit?" Often think of this, that here is really where the altar is. Here's the core and the center. For myself to honor the temple that God has given to me, and to, you know, and for you too, to honor all the senses that we have, what we hear, what we feel, and what we intuit, and not ignore those things. And therefore also a dream is another dimension that can assist us. Because a lot of times, you see, we may ignore some of our feelings, push them down, be too embarrassing to deal with it, or too threatening. Or a lot of time it's easier to feel guilty than deal with some other kind of feeling. Under guilt usually is anger, behind guilt. It's easier to walk away from a situation and what has happened and end up feeling guilty about it or feeling bad about it. Underneath your feeling bad and guilty about it is that something went wrong in a situation and you're probably, you know, resentful of it or angry about it. But it's scary to deal with anger. So we back away. And therefore fear comes in. It's scary to deal with anger. I think somebody was just talking about fear kind of being earlier today. That fear is probably kind of a fundamental one. And anger. Anger is a secondary emotion. You get threatened, hurt. Anger is a response that can come, or resentment. And somehow we easily shift this over into maybe feeling bad about something, and then we can feel guilty. And it's more comfortable to feel guilty because you then blame yourself. You actually turn the anger then toward yourself. That's good. Well, now. So I want to get into how to work with the dream. made a little list of things here. First is to, of course, to put paper and pencil beside the bed, bring a sense of commitment, willingness to take the time to write down what you've dreamt. You don't have to write it down fully in total detail, just maybe a sentence or two so that you can remember it. And if it's sort of a little long dream, maybe just write a few things out of each little section of the dream so that you can recall it. In recording the dream, the four W's question, where, when, who, and what. Where are you? You know, location of the dream, when, time of day even, might be night or morning, or is it, are you back in high school? So it might be, might place you back in time. So the location is helpful. If the location is back in your hometown at a particular time, somehow there's an importance to the time and place there, to your own emotional life and the issues that you were facing at that time. Somehow they're parallel to what you're dealing with now. So that's why the dream takes you, places you back then. The who, well, persons, of course, all the persons, and there may be animals in the dreams. The what, what happens, what action goes on, what drama, what feelings are there in the dream, and how does it end? Usually ending is a kind of a statement from the unconscious of the unresolved facets or issues stated in the dream. That's not always the case. There could be an ending to the dream that's a real happy resolution, because the person may have been facing a lot of anxiety, and that the dream is a resolution. I had a friend who was going in for heart surgery, and he had two dreams that were related to the surgery that was coming up. One was that he was a huge airplane, and he was just flying through the air, and he was a pastor in San Francisco, and he had to bring this airplane down. And so there was all kinds of anxiety and finding a place. He wasn't near the airport, but somehow he gets down into a big parking lot area, and he lands this big plane, and he's relieved. So, well, the surgery is on his body. He's kind of up in the air, you know, not very solid, no security. There he is, out there. And the other dream had a sense of humor in it, too. This fellow was very good at telling jokes. He had always a quick sense of humor. And he could do that in the pulpit as well. So, if you know San Francisco, it has many steep hills. And in this dream, he's coming down one of these steep hills in a soapbox cart, you know, your little wheels that kids put together for a race. But it's a soapbox, and it's sort of maybe a little play on the pulpit and the stand up on the pulpit. But anyway, he's in this, and there's no steering wheel. So here he's coasting down this hill, and up the hill is coming a great big semi-truck. And how is he going to scare to death? And he finds that if he just leans one way or the other, that the cart will turn. And so he leans, and the cart makes a turn and goes around the corner. And he's relieved and safe. So those two dreams came prior to his open heart surgery, and it gave him a sense of relief and confidence that he was going to make it through. You know, in a way, he couldn't do anything tangible, in a way. It was sort of like he just trust enough here, you know, a small thing that he could do. And it was sort of like having faith. Hey, maybe I can affect this. Having faith and trust that I can make this thing turn. Okay, so the ending of a dream doesn't always have to be dramatic, or that is a negative or confrontive, but many times it does leave us facing something that needs to be dealt with. Also, when you record the dream later, when you say maybe writing into a journal, a dream journal, write it in the first person present tense. And another suggestion is that after you've written it, you might go through it and put in your personal pronouns in front of the people or some of the significant parts of the dream, even objects. See, in one sense, every aspect of the dream is part of you. It can have some statement about the outer people in your dream, but most often, at least one of the basic elements of it is that they are all about you. So if your friend Bill is in the dream, my Bill, you can stick in, I put it in parentheses. It's just sort of, hey, let's own, what is Bill like? What are his qualities, his character, and the way in which he's different from me, and what is he contributing in this story of the dream?
Roy?
Yeah?
So, are you saying that it doesn't matter who else is in the dream? The dream's not about them. The dream is about me. And so if I see my mom, my dad, my brothers in the dream, those are really the mom, dad, and brothers' qualities in me. Is that what you're saying?
Yes and no. I think maybe your mom and dad are in the dream. They may well be something saying, making some statement about your relationship to your mom and dad.
I wouldn't bank on it.
spouse, too.
I would also say that you could play with that. You'd be the one to decide.
That's a good point. It's up to the dreamer to decide about it.
How much is outer and how much is the person to gain.
But the statement, your dreams are always about you. I mean, whatever is in there is you.
That's true. It's your dream.
I often think of it, both elements being, see, it isn't either or, it's both. I can take a look at the dream in terms of it, everything being an aspect of myself, and I can also take a look at the dream as it's saying something about what's going on out in my day-to-day world. And particularly if the dream is much closer to some very real situation that you're living out, you know, in the outer world, then it's maybe a big element of it is about the outer world.
Did you have some particular thought?
No, I'm just trying to understand when he said about Bill, my Bill, does that mean my friend Bill, or does that mean the Bill in me?
The Bill in you.
Yes.
Yeah, I meant it that way, the Bill in you. Mm-hmm. And to own, in other words, one thing the dream shows us, that a lot of times we have, are fragmented. I mean, that's a little strong word for it. At least Fitz Perls always said that the dreams were fragments. that we are fragmented. He was like a little bit heavy on it. And that we need to integrate these aspects, these fragmented parts. And often we are ignoring that aspect or rejecting that aspect. And or we are not aware of it. And it may be a very positive figure. And we're not aware of having those strengths. So it's important to own them. But like we say, own your power. So own the parts of the dream. I was going to say something about when... I guess I was going to give an illustration.
Some discussion.
Okay. There's one thing not to include though is things that are in the dream. The one dream I'm remembering is a dream about a red carpet. It was a woman's dream. And the setting of the dream is a hotel, and it's sinister. And there's a mafia around. There's gangster kind of people somewhere in the building. But it's a real fancy, luxurious hotel. And as she comes in, she's really struck by the beauty of the red, soft carpet rug. And so, one of the things was to be the carpet, to be the rug that she was so struck by. And when she got into that, she realized how she was being walked on. So that if she owned that split off fragment aspect of her life and got in touch with it, she realized that a lot of her behavior and the way she was acting, she was letting people walk on her. And so that was, you know, really dramatic for her. Well, maybe there are a couple more things and little methods, but maybe if there's some questions or a little discussion here, then, or someone has a dream that they're wondering about. Yeah. Well, a diagram and even the structure, the psychological structure, is a crude thing when it comes to putting it up against the mind and the psyche. So I would think that the dream comes from many aspects, an interplay. There could well be an interplay between aspects of the unconscious and the ego. So that the ego, see, your ego is always in the dream. So there may be, you know, this is just crude, you know, when it comes, we are a whole, so we're not broken down into parts. So this is a little bit like a road map to give you some sense that how the ego, or ourself, is in relationship to a much larger source within us. And of course, there's the left brain, right brain functioning, and I think that plays a part in the dream process. In our waking life, the ego is the center of consciousness. And we can recall various things, but we're not concentrated on all things at once. So we're the center of consciousness. I don't think the ego is not in charge of what's coming through. I think that the psyche, the deeper psyche, the psycho, you know, the brain and the psyche and the emotions, the body, are sending messages. And what comes through, we do know this, that what comes through to us is basically something that we can handle.
That is it also the mystery? We do, there's a lot that we just don't know.
Yeah. So, but
about how that all operates. And we call it God. It's beyond us in a way. And so we try to give words and diagram it, give it structure. But that was the difference between Freud and Jung. Jung was willing to go all out on the limb for the mysterious, the unknown, and that's why he wasn't recognized as science, because he couldn't answer questions that specifically. But as you experience what we're talking about, you kind of know, a different kind of knowing. Does that make sense?
I guess I was just curious too, when you dream, you know, is that giving you information that, you know, you have a dream that's like your carpet dream, that tells you something that you, in your conscious life, aren't willing to, is it giving you information you for some reason consciously won't get, or?
Yeah, it's if you don't, you don't work with the dream, you're, we talked a little bit about reoccurring dreams. And a reoccurring dream usually is sort of tapping, you know, knocking at the door to get you to pay attention. There's something to be resolved. And it usually ends with always the same unresolved situation. So when one begins to work with it and identify what it's about, and then deal with the outer situation that it's traumatizing for you, then that dream will disappear. And so I think that is one good way of illustrating that, the reoccurring dream. And like you're saying, well, maybe somebody would miss. Now, the dream that I referred to about the red carpet, sometimes a person will get a dream that's so scary that it motivates them to do something and get help. So, you know, that's another level of it, the dream. This particular woman, the first dream that she had, she was in a swamp, like a swamp in the southern parts of the States, and she's trying to wade out of this soggy swamp, and as she's in water up to about her waist, and as she's making her way out, she looks down in the water and she sees herself as about 8 to 10 years old under the water, drowning. And she's scared, of course, very scared, and struggles to get out of the water. And as she's getting out, she's confronted by a monster, a huge dragon. And that was, that's where the dream ends. That drove her into therapy. So. And then she began to work on it, and she did resolve the issues.
But I think that something that's important to say is that dreams aren't that hard to work with. Once you learn how to do it and see how it works and find someone to work with you, someone that has some experience in doing that, it isn't that hard to find meaning. A lot of people, once they start working with them, almost see immediately what it's saying if they take time. So it is it.
Yeah, the other thing too is that the dream themes will repeat. So that if one dream is a little bit difficult, some of the same themes will usually come up again. Now what you can also do, and I'll just quickly, is to get associations to different parts of the dream. You're probably familiar with that, of getting, going through the things you've identified in the dream and recall any associations or events or activities that were similar. Review what's happened with you in the last few days, because usually a dream is responding or taking things from the last few days to make a statement. And that may help to, it may pick up innocent things, but use it as a symbolic language. And so if you identify where it came from, usually you get a clue then, what's the point of it picking up one of these chairs and having that chair in the dream, or this symbol on the back, you know. It'll put things together.
I'm wondering if someone has one that's kind of clear, but you don't know what it means, what you want to talk about it. So it's a question about something that you thought about. Mm-hmm. You?
Yeah, I got one.
You want to talk, is it too personal to talk about it?
Well, I'm at my parents' home, and all of my belongings, all the things that I have with me here at Holden, are in my sister's room. And there's a fire in the house. And all the firefighters who come are handicapped. And you need a sign language interpreter.
And you need a sign language interpreter, you say?
Yeah, and the fire's put out, and I have a feeling there wasn't a huge amount of damage, but there are all these people coming in and out of the house. And I start getting worried about all my things in the other room, that, you know, that somebody's going to steal something, and I go in there, and somebody has cut out my driver's license and my MasterCard from my wallet. Mm.
They have stolen it?
Yeah, they have stolen it.
And also, you said some of your things over here are left at Holden?
Yeah.
And then you had some things with you in the house, and you were in your sister's room?
My sister's room. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that I sort of came to a decision when I came to Holden that I boxed up a bunch of things in my life that I couldn't really do here and put them in my closet. And it was like those things I knew would be okay from the fire, mm-hmm. but the things that I was using now,
that, you know, that I was using every day, I thought were more likely to get damaged. Mm-hmm. Oh. Fascinating. Fire. Fire can have a number of, you know, of different meanings. What is fire for you? Have you had any fires in the past?
Fires. There were no fires when I was growing up. You know, our house never burned down or anything.
Mm-hmm. Are you particularly scared of fires? So that isn't an issue. Okay. And see, fire can could be related to angry feelings, and it also is an element for transformation. Fire transforms things, and it could be some elements of both, that anger and transformation may be interrelated.